You are listening to Access to Perspectives Conversations, and my name is Joe Haferman. Today we're here with Nitya Chetty, professor of physics at Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg, South Africa. Welcome, Nitya.
Very glad to be here, Joe. Thank you very much for reaching out to me.
You wrote a commentary that was published in University World News Africa edition on the 10th of March this year. And in that commentary, you expressed your concern about the war in Ukraine and the need, in your view, for scientific diplomacy in the light of historical events in South Africa. Could you please tell us a bit more about that?
So obviously, we're all extremely unhappy, to say the very least, with what's going on with the Russian invasion into Ukraine. And what really piqued my curiosity was South Africa abstaining from a non-binding vote at the United Nations. And that raised a lot of eyebrows amongst us scientists here in South Africa, because we have strong research collaborations with both Ukraine and Russia. And so abstaining from a vote that condemned Russia's aggression was quite difficult for us to understand. I got to say that South Africa has had a very tortured and very difficult history going back many centuries, based on racial segregation and not respecting human rights and so on. And I would think, following from the end of apartheid and release of Nelson Mandela, of course. And for a brief while, I thought that South Africa had the moral courage to stand up and to speak forthrightly on injustices in this world. And I've got to say that was my primary reason for getting involved in this discussion. And that was that the government sought fit from a political point of view not to strongly condemn the invasion. So as a scientist, I'm a physicist here at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. I'm currently the Dean of the Faculty of Science. And I thought that, I tried to follow a little bit of the conversations that had taken place, not only within South Africa, but abroad. And I just want to say that a number of our academics in South Africa did grow very anxious about the South African position. So I thought I'd state my case, which I did, and I'm very glad that you picked up on my piece, and so did a number of other colleagues in many different parts in South Africa and abroad. So I'm glad that I was able to at least to help shape some thinking around the role of science in this time of war. So I would say that two aspects that come to mind when one talks about science and war, Joe, and the one is the more obvious one. You would hear a lot of folks saying that science has created the environment for war to take place. I think one has to, of course, that is true. You can't dispute that. But I think there's an important role that science has always played and can play and should play going into the future, and we should think about that. Of course, my first prize, of course, I wish that there was no possibility for war. There's no doubt about it. I wish that we could resolve our problems amicably. But if we go back on history, you know this as well as I, over all of time, that there's always been war. And so perhaps then we've got to accept that war's inevitable from time to time, and that we simply then now need to minimize the effects of war and always try to resolve conflicts amicably. That ought to be our starting position. But science has contributed to war. Let me start off with the negative aspects of science to war. There's no question in my mind that so long as there's been warlords, there have been interest in weapons, and the basis of weapons has been science, technology, and engineering. We've got to accept that. However, if one takes a very negative view about the role of science in this environment of conflict, then one simply misses out on an important part that science can play in the context of scientific diplomacy. So if you look at nuclear fission, for instance, in your great country is where nuclear fission was discovered, uranium atom was first split. in Germany. Your city played an important part in the 30s. And that was a purely basic scientific inquiry. It was just, you know, we're fascinated by the fact that you can split a uranium atom. It was purely curiosity-driven science. But it didn't take long before folk began to realize the possibilities of turning this into a weapon of mass destruction. And the same can be true of other scientific enterprises, isn't it? You can look at chemistry and biology and so on. I mean, you can't stop people from researching into anthrax. You can't stop people into engineers from researching into how it is that you can project some kind of a projectile into space at you know, with minimal effort and maximal sort of power. Those are scientific problems, but the moment you start in engaging on those problems with scientific kind of curiosity, you invariably have individuals who are looking on the fringes, looking at possible ways in which that can be exploited for destruction. So we've got to recognize that one should not ignore the role that science has played in what currently looks like an existential threat that we are facing on this planet, and that is a worry. So I would say that is mostly directed research, and this is a key point that I would like to make in our conversation today, that when research is directed by the government, for instance, or by even commercial organizations where they have a commercial interest, very little ethical value kind of comes to frame the work. I mean, folk just simply see this as an instrument for political gain or an instrument for economic gain, and so there's no regard to the threat that this could pose toward humanity. And so the question that I ask you, Joe, how can we counter this? What is a reasonable kind of credible way in which we can counter this? And it's a difficult thing to do, to stand up to this. And my the central part of my message in my commentary was that we must, democratic nations must nurture an environment of free inquiry, of critical thinking, of intellectual discourse, of having the freedom to speak truth to power and to ask the right questions and not to be afraid to do that. And we must constantly, as a human race on this planet, seek to achieve an environment where that can happen. Now, in this regard, then, science plays an extremely important role because, you know, the remarkable thing is that you can travel half the way around the world. I've traveled to Berlin, beautiful city, traveled to Beijing, to San Francisco, to South America, and so on. You can cross many different boundaries, cross political boundaries, cross geographic boundaries, linguistic boundaries, et cetera, but you still speak the same language of science. And that's an important matter that we should not overlook, that when political discourse fails, and currently today in the Ukrainian Russian conflict, you see that is failing in a very spectacular way. My point is that we've got to keep the scientific channels of collaborations open, because those engagements are based on rational discourse, on critical thinking, on asking the right questions, on really, you know, rationalizing the situation for what it is. And if we shut down that channel of communication, Joe, is when I think we can really end up in a situation that's not so different from, say, North Korea, where you have a pariah type of state. And you have no dialogue between the rational folk that can keep those engagements open. So I would say that those are the most important points. You asked me what motivated me. I think I've answered that. My conscience obviously forced me to step in, but scientific diplomacy, folk are often do blame science for the causes of the power behind war. And I don't disagree with that, but I want to say that we must, in our democratic system, strive to have an environment where we can have rational discourse and engagements across these many different divides that helps build friendships ultimately. And this should not be underestimated as a force for peace.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I agree with what you said in regards to how can we bring scientific diplomacy to life. In the article in University World News, you outlined a few starting points, and you also mentioned here just now, we need to keep the conversation open. So are you suggesting we should continue to collaborate with Russian researchers, and how is it possible to differentiate between those who are supportive of the attacks by Putin, like if centralized to one person in power to, of course, the conflict, but of course with supporting people in his government, and those who are opposed the war explicitly and now find themselves also in life-threatening situations?
So that's a really good question, of course. And I would say that we wouldn't necessarily wage a witch hunt trying to distinguish very carefully between those who are independent and critical and those who could be collaborating. But I think the moment there is evidence that is quite clear that individuals are supporting the war effort or contributing to weapons development, then of course one will have a serious problem with that. But do keep in mind, Joe, that a number of Russian scientists very early on in this war did very bravely, I would suggest, express themselves in opposition to this war. and it's, you know, they've been, it's been under enormous threat of imprisonment and possibly also violent attacks against them, as we've seen some protesters being roughed up out in Moscow. So a lot of folk have stood up. I think that we know the Russian scientific community well enough, because we've had many decades of scientific engagements with Russia right across the world, that we do know that, you know, many of the Russian scientists, the vast majority of them, share the values that we aspire for. It's difficult for them to really now, under the current circumstances, a month into this war, be able to express themselves very, very explicitly. So it's really this distinction between directed research, where you have research laboratories and scientists working in national kind of arms industry in Russia that are collaborating with the government. I get that those individuals would be considered to be problems in my estimation. But we're looking at the open science systems environments where individuals have historically engaged in the manner that I've spoken about, and I think we should be very careful about isolating science, open critical science in Russia. I think it will set us back considerably. We should already start thinking about the rebuilding phase, isn't it? This war hopefully will come to an end, I hope sooner rather than later. And I envisage and hope for a time sooner rather than later when we can begin the rebuilding phase. And it's precisely this cohort of scientists within Russia that are going to be important for us to reach out to from the international perspective.
So pragmatic ways to approach this. Now, I've also heard from not necessarily scientists, but people who are scared of what you just said, that Russia could turn into a bigger North Korea, like being isolated, not only from inside, but also being expelled from all kinds of international consortia, including scientific consortia, which has happened. Some have refrained from excluding their Russian colleagues, but there's certainly a stir up and reconsideration. How do you think collaborations with an aggressor state like Russia and the researchers within can be kept up for active research, or in a way to support the researchers, even if they're currently not in a position or capable of conducting research the way they would like to?
So before I answer your question, I don't want the audience to get the impression that I'm batting strongly for Russia here. It would be remiss of me not to firstly at least emphasize where the real tragedy is. If I could, and I haven't had the chance to talk about this, I do want to say that it's a great, grave tragedy what is happening in Ukraine, and from the point of view of our own academic collaborations in that country, it's really of catastrophic consequences. I worry greatly about the scientists and students, including students from South Africa, because Ukraine has taken on a number of students over recent years, and they've had to flee the country and head over to places like Poland, and of course we know of the wanton destruction of property, millions of people displaced, thousands of people killed, but really it's a destruction of educational, research, and cultural facilities that I think is a grave tragedy, and really indicates the full wrath of the Putin regime. So with that, then I want to say that our greatest interest, our greatest efforts from around the world has to be focused on helping the Ukrainian scientists. So before I answer your question about the Russian scientists, which is certainly a matter that I will discuss, but clearly the urgent issue that we need to talk about is the Ukrainian scientists. I'd like us to find ways in which we can home the scientists out in neighboring areas. But even here within South Africa, I hope that we could create an opportunity where, at least in principle, we can receive Ukrainian scholars in our midst. And we have a long history, incidentally, of Ukrainian scholars that have immigrated to South Africa. I'm the dean of the Faculty of Science. We in our 100th year, our university was established in 1922. In the early 50s, one Boris Belinsky had immigrated to South Africa, and he became the dean. He was sitting not literally on this chair that I sit on now, but he figuratively, more or less the year that I was born, it turns out, so it was a long time ago. He became the dean of the Faculty of Science and quite an excellent scientist. And we have many other Ukrainian scientists here at Wits University. We have a top quality mathematician who had already applied for sabbatical leave to Kiev for this year. And just, so tragically, only barely a couple of weeks ago did I have to sign off on his postponement of his sabbatical to Ukraine. So even though we, tens of thousands of kilometers away, we're very direct, we are directly affected. There's no question about it. And I hope that we can reach out to the Ukrainians, especially because of the South African abstention in the United Nations. The real litmus test, as far as I'm concerned with the South African vote, is whether South Africa is really willing to condemn the violence in to the extent that it needs to, in the strongest possible terms, but also not turn its back on Ukraine. Ukraine has been an important intellectual partner for South Africa. It will be a great tragedy. So I do want to state that very clearly, that I'm very concerned and very sympathetic toward the plight of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian scientists and academics in particular. But so with that as a backdrop, then I'm happy to talk about Russia. I mean, Russian scientists do not need a lot of help right now. I don't think that we need to be doing anything extraordinary to reach out to the Russians. Russians continue to participate in meetings, international meetings. Many meetings occur online, thanks to COVID. So that is happening worldwide. Nobody is saying that you should not participate in meetings. I think some international scientific meetings that were scheduled to happen in Russia are probably being delayed or postponed or even canceled. So I don't think that we need to be doing anything extraordinary, but we should, what I'm saying is that we should not undermine those efforts. I'm saying we should not shut down those channels of communication, but there's nothing extra that we need to be doing beyond what we have done, but the relationship is not as strong as the scientific relationship with every other country won't be as strong as it had been barely a month ago. It can't be because of what has happened.
Thank you also for stressing the support, obviously, for the urgent need for support for Ukrainian researchers. There is quite a bit of initiatives, or quite a lot of initiatives, in especially in the research arena. There's a website that's been put up, I think, less than 2 weeks into the war. It's called Science for Ukraine. And also various sign-up lists, spreadsheets, where researchers from around the world can sign up and list spaces for housing and research opportunities that they have, particularly for Ukrainian researchers. We will put this also in the show notes. And we've also reported on this in previous episodes of this podcast and also on our website. And yes, there is... Obviously, like, as universities also being bombed in various cities now in Ukraine, there is, as you suggest, also we should already plan, because the urgency is real and the destruction is happening as we speak. How can we then later on, once peace is reinstalled, how can we help to rebuild the scientific community in the country? And also, how can we collaborate in the meantime and support Ukrainian researchers in particular, who are now left without any research facilities, and also at the brink of, well, without housing or anywhere to go. The support system within Europe is quite strong, but more and more people fleeing the country. I think we happily spread more news about these opportunities to support. And I also agree that what you said with regards to the science diplomacy, that we keep up the dialogues with Russian researchers, many of which are also binational. We've heard many stories that many Russians have their roots in Ukraine, there's many intermarriages. So, and it affects the whole world with the trade network that we've built over the past 40, 50 years. Poverty is going to increase across the continent in sub-Saharan Africa. There's already, the effects are already showing, the ripple effects of this very regional war, but what it has onto the world. Would you, like, maybe towards the conclusion of this conversation, what do you think how interdisciplinary science communication and interdisciplinary efforts in analyzing the situation could help? I'm thinking particularly around including or bringing to the table also political scientists, researchers with a focus on peace and conflict studies, conflict resolution studies. Don't we have enough evidence on how to avoid such situations already? And how do you think scientists can influence politicians and inform politicians of less emotional, more rational decision making?
So academics have an important role in this. There's no doubt about it. I myself am a theoretical physicist, and yet I've gotten involved in this discussion, because it's ultimately a matter that should interest every single human being on this planet. I don't know that one has to have a specialization. Political scientists, folk art in the humanities faculties, of course, they understand the history a little bit better, and will understand the environment a little better. They will also hopefully be able to, you know, give suggestions of possible areas that could have the potential for conflict. So in that sense, yes, I mean, we tend to be reactionary, isn't it? Something happens and then we all get so heavily involved in this. But the question that I ask is, could this have been predicted? Yes, of course. I mean, the tensions have been building up for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And could we have established dialogue already? Political dialogue, academic dialogue, could we have gotten, people together, peace-loving people, I would suggest, to really, find ways in which we could build bridges between both the countries, rather than create difficulties. So I think we certainly should have been more proactive with regard to the issues in Ukraine. I mean, for the longest time now, tensions have built up. Ukraine had become a sort of a background for a lot of what a lot of the Trump administration kind of shenanigans as well, and that did not help. So you know, what we really need is to be able to talk very critically and very openly about the wrongs that have been happening, and we should have been doing this and alerted the world to the potential of this problem. Now we're so very deep in it, I think we're very much on the back foot, so to speak, and very much in a reactive way. My hope is that that dialogue will continue, both political dialogue and certainly scientific dialogue, I said, should not be stopped, because that is important for now, but also for the rebuilding phase. My great hope is that we will have a cessation of the violence, and that reasonable people can come together and mediate a solution that can work positively for both Russia and Ukraine. I mean, we want a peaceful coexistence of both the countries with each other. And what we all have observed with Ukraine is that there's been a universal or almost universal kind of outrage that's been expressed by people around the world. I mean, not all. I mean, I mentioned the South African government has been very cagey about this because of their BRICS relationship. We're part of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. That's the BRICS corporation. But despite some of these, and there were five countries, of course, that voted in support of Russia, including Russia at the United Nations. Another 35 countries, I think, that abstained. But the vast majority of countries did vote to support the condemnation of Russia. So I think there's hope, and I hope we can end this conversation on a note of hope. This has galvanized the democratic-loving people from around the world. There's no question about it. And here I'm talking about ordinary people, people on the streets, and of course I speak very, very forthrightly, I think, you know, on behalf of academics, because I'm in many ways, you know, engaging mostly with the academic community, not just here in South Africa, but abroad as well. And there's been universal condemnation. So that's something positive. And once we usher into an era of peace, my hope is that we can get rational discussions that take place that do not involve, you know, or not dominated by those who have a destructive kind of nature, but those who really are keen to ensure lasting peace. And I would say that, you know, the future of Ukraine can be very bright. It can be very bright. I can see Ukraine as becoming a symbol for international engagements, because the entire world has reached out to Ukraine. I don't know that we've been able to help very much in real terms, but the sympathy has been there. And I think Ukraine can, in a post-war environment, draw on a lot of that positive energy that has been expressed from around the world. So I see Ukraine as becoming a center for international cooperation, for, you know, really speaking out against human rights violations and becoming a champion for peace and goodwill. I can see Ukraine really stepping up to achieving that kind of status in a post-war situation. So I do want to say that I'm very hopeful that Ukraine will usher in peace, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I share your notion of ending this conversation on a hopeful note. And yeah, we can leave it here. We provide a few resources in the comment section and the show notes to this episode. If you'd like, you're most welcome to share any concluding remarks, anything else you would like to share.
So of course, I serve on the International Union for Pure and Applied Physics. I'm the vice president there, and this is the Global Voice for Physics. And I want to say that we've been very concerned at that level about the fate of Ukrainian physics and science more general. So I'm very glad that I've also been able to participate in those engagements that have involved countries from around the world. So I guess I should mention that here, that it's also helped shape my thinking. And I do want to acknowledge the International Union for Pure and Applied Physics and all of the council members. And I serve as vice president responsible for membership matters. I think that's been that helped me think about the importance of scientific diplomacy and scientific engagements on a international scale, because if you can create an environment where scientists can talk with each other in a rational way, I think this world can be a better place.
Yeah, thank you so much, and all the best for your future engagements. Here you have a few interviews on this topic lined up. And thanks for making time for our conversation as well.
It's been a pleasure, really, Joe. Thank you so much for reaching out. I appreciate that. All the very best then from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thank you.